Hello, and welcome to our Highmark Virtual Health Telehealth 101 podcast, where we will be discussing everything you need to know as a provider. I am Michelle Bond, the Director of Enterprise Virtual Health. I am a nurse by background and healthcare leader with 25 plus years of experience in managerial, administrative, budgetary, and operational responsibilities. In my own career, I've been successful at leading innovative approaches to incorporate products and technology into the clinical setting. For example, introducing virtual health to ensure excellent patient care outcomes, clinical satisfaction, and decreased costs. Today, we'll talk about what virtual health is, how to conduct a virtual care visit, share national trends, and answer common questions on coding, reimbursement, as well as current and pending legislation. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'd now like to introduce our guests from Highmark Health's Virtual Health and Clinical Services Enterprise team, Laura Messino, Matt Fair, and Dr. Timothy Loth. Laura Messino, who is our Vice President of Enterprise for Virtual Health, is a dynamic nursing leader in the healthcare industry. With nearly two decades of experience in virtual health, Laura has proven successes implementing virtual health solutions to drive clinical performance and financial metrics. Laura is a national speaker and member of the American Telemedicine Association and also Healthcare Information and Management Systems Society. In addition, Laura serves as a board member for Partnership for Connected Illinois. And then Matthew Fair, he is the manager of Enterprise Virtual Health for Highmark Health. He is a collaborative, passionate, and innovative leader. He looks to drive organizational goals by standardizing, developing, and implementing virtual health programs to augment patient care and solve for access to healthcare when there is a need. He has over 16 years' experience in healthcare, 5 years as a senior IT analyst supporting virtual health initiatives from an IT perspective, and over 3 years leading and managing a virtual health department for a large healthcare organization. And we are also excited to have with us Dr. Tim Law. He is the Senior Medical Director for Clinical Services at Highmark Inc. Dr. Law is a rural family physician utilizing virtual health for over 20 years. He has been a strong advocate for telemedicine for over 20 years on both the provider and the payer side. Dr. Law speaks internationally on the utilization and provider implementation of telemedicine and remote patient monitoring. He runs a remote rural practice for the Amish, Mennonite, and Plain communities, primarily across Kentucky and Ohio, but also sees virtual patients across the United States, including the Dominican Republic. He is also currently the clinical lead on the Highmark COVID Command Center and COVID coverage and reimbursement work groups. He leads the virtual health strategy team on the clinical side of Highmark and is involved in the day-to-day operation of telemedicine code utilization and enhancements since the beginning of the public health emergency. He is going to share his expertise on virtual health and a few insights on what the current and the future state of virtual health looks like now and after the COVID-19 public health emergency has ended. So first, we would like to define what virtual health is. Laura, what is your definition of virtual health?
I define virtual health as the use of medical information that's exchanged from one site to another in order to improve the clinical status of a patient.
Can you tell us about some of the various use cases?
Sure. There's a wide variety of use cases within the virtual health space. You know, the first I always like to talk about is diagnosis and treatment. Some of the most common examples of that can be telestroke or virtual urgent care. We also have professional consultation, and really that could be from provider to provider consultations. As an example, a primary care physician that wants to bring in a behavioral health specialist right into a visit with a patient. But it can also be where it is just provider to provider, where maybe a case is highlighted to another provider and you're getting some professional recommendations. And then another aspect is monitoring and care coordination. And probably the most widely utilized one is remote patient monitoring, where we're using sophisticated algorithms in order to predict changes in a patient's condition.
So Laura, can you talk about the different modalities it can be leveraged with?
There are really three different modalities. The first being real-time virtual visits. This uses live two-way audio video technology, very similar to what we're using right now during this podcast. And then the second one being asynchronous storm forward. That is where there's no face-to-face interaction. It is where information is shared transparently through an email exchange. And then the third one is really remote patient monitoring, where it uses a platform with sophisticated algorithms that's built in to identify subtle changes in a patient's condition. The example could be congestive heart failure, COPD, or diabetes.
Great. So can you give us some examples of other platforms that could be utilized in the virtual health delivery?
Sure. We can use many different devices, such as smart devices, our iOS, Android devices, iPads, desktops, laptops. A wide variety of apps are utilized in the space, along with kiosks, where it can be a centralized site that has a kiosk and has peripheral devices attached to it so that you can really get that clinical auscultation and assessment completed. There's also Bluetooth peripheral devices, things that are at our patients' homes, like a glucometer or a scale. And there's also, a lot of different aspects where these four items are really blended together.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Law, would you like to add anything to that?
Yes, I think in addition to those excellent points that we need to remember that virtual health includes both telemedicine and telehealth, which not only encompasses the direct and indirect patient care scenarios that Laura mentioned, but also the distance learning and sharing of ideas for healthcare professionals. Doctors, nurses, others across the healthcare spectrum are training, sharing virtual ideas, and interacting with each other from across the way for specialty care and things like that.
Great. So during the global pandemic, many providers used virtual health. So during this time, what are some benefits the providers saw? And actually, Laura, could you start us off with that?
Sure. Over the pandemic, we saw a lot of advances in why providers saw value in delivering services virtually, such as it enabled them to better collaborate and coordinate care virtually, better manage chronic conditions, and ensure medication adherence. There's been a lot of published data since the public health emergency, and I'll just highlight a couple of aspects. According to McKinsey, 35% of outpatient encounters, office visits, and home health services are virtualizable. We also saw that as of April 2021, 84% of physicians were offering virtual visits. And we also saw that many physicians saw great value that they were able to increase their patient volumes and throughput, but also that they had a better work-life balance where they could blend the two of traditional in-person and virtual.
Great. And Dr. Law, what have you seen personally in your practice?
Well, my practice has fully utilized virtual health from its inception 20 plus years ago, prior to myself even being in the military medicine. And to Laura's point, that ability to interact with your patients and create that work-life balance has been huge. During the pandemic, myself with six grandchildren here at the house, it was often a fear of doing house calls and bringing stuff home or having the patient show up here at the home to possibly expose the grandchildren to these different diseases. We were able to move a lot of the things I would normally have them just show up at the house and see. I would do it virtually. During the pandemic, these services went up not just in volume, but also in scope, right? So things that some patients felt could only be done in person were now being done virtually. So things like rash evaluations, upper respiratory infections, especially during the pandemic, is it COVID? Is it a cold? Is it sinus infection? Is it an ear infection? Even things such as a laceration evaluation, which you would never expect to look at someone's cut and say, hey, am I going to evaluate this virtually? But you can look at it and say, yeah, this is something that needs stitches, or no, this is not something that needs stitches. You can clean this up at home during the lockdown, especially. You can clean this up at home and do this and that and instruct them how to do it right over a virtual airway, whether it be FaceTime or any other platform. And then, of course, fracture evaluation. We have digital space x-rays now. So my patients could go get a digital x-ray. I can read it on my phone and live and online and tell them whether or not they need to come to my house or go to the emergency room or do this or that. And so they don't have to increase their exposure and also decrease their cost of care at the same time.
Laura, what has happened to change the environment for virtual health?
Well, quite honestly, before the pandemic, virtual health was a nice to have. And when the pandemic hit, it became a need to have. This is due to a wide variety of reasons, such as there's been a change in a shift in consumer attitudes. Our consumers are looking for convenient healthcare. We've also seen a huge wave of private equity investments. We've seen entry of consumer and digital companies. And we've also seen rising health disparity with issues to access to care. During the pandemic, we actually saw skyrocketing adoption of virtual health. We also saw a huge change to an insourced program versus outsourced. We saw that providers were embracing virtual health and embedding it into their practices. We've also seen an expansion in direct-to-consumer models, in order to meet the needs of our consumers that are wanting care 24/7 at any point in time. We've also seen an increase of new programs that have come, such as hospital to home. We've also seen an expansion of remote patient monitoring. And we've also seen new reimbursement, especially with easing of CMS rules. We're still waiting to see what that looks like in the future, but that had been a great advantage where previously, patients had to be in a rural zone in order to be reimbursed from a CMS perspective. So that was a great opportunity. And then also tighter cybersecurity.
What are some things that you see nationally related to utilization?
We're watching national utilization trends every month. And currently right now, what we're seeing is that 13 to 17% of visits are virtual visits. But what we have also seen is that behavioral health is actually the most prominently utilized. And that is at a 61% utilization rate.
And Dr. Law, what is your perspective?
Yeah, for Highmark in particular, during the first year of the public health emergency, we saw 3.4 million virtual health services supplied to Highmark members across our footprint. That equated to a 3,400% increase over the previous year for physical health and an 8,000% increase for behavioral health, to Laura's point. And that has really stuck even since. As you see, it's 61% nationally. So the numbers were really up. And it went from something that was, oh, that was nice to see. And Laura has given talks. I've given talks all over the world, basically. And people would say, well, that sounds like a really nice way to try some medicine, but it'll never stick. And now, of course, when the pandemic hit, everyone's like, oh, wait, what was that you were telling me about the virtual health part? So everyone wants to know about it now because it's really just a nowadays part of our life in the medical world for sure.
Yeah, that's amazing. So how is virtual health affecting the current landscape of brick and mortar traditional healthcare? Is it sustainable moving forward? Laura, let's start with you.
I think there's a great opportunity for providers and also for patients. An example of that is providers embedding virtual into their practice and really having every provider realize that it's a tool in their pocket and to use either traditional in-person or virtual in order to meet the needs of their patients. We also know that patients enjoy receiving care virtually. It's convenient. It reduces their travel times. We also have seen that patients are increasing seeing providers virtually who may not have previously sought out treatment. It's also a huge patient satisfier.
Great. And Dr. Law, would you like to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think some years back, we went to this concierge type of medicine where people wanted the convenience of not having to leave work or their home. And so you had one doctor that you could call and always kind of have on the line. And then doctors started doing house calls. So my practice is all house call practice, not for the convenience so much of the patient that's working in an office, but because they don't have transportation and they're very rural. But it was also happening in cities. And now this has turned the tides to make the convenience not only just for the patient, but also for the doctor, because now you can also save time. So for instance, to go to do a house call for one patient, it might end up taking you an hour and a half, 15 to 20 minute ride, 30 minutes at the house, another 15 to 20 minutes back to your office. So this can, now you can see how many patients, maybe one every 15 or 10 minutes on a virtual space at your office and do that. There was a McKinsey report that found that 40% of surveyed consumers would continue to use some form of virtual health after, even after the public health emergency is over. But I think, because to Laura's point, it was for convenience, and they liked it. You know, it was a good experience for them. And that's up from only 11% prior to the public health emergency. So huge, you know, almost a fourfold increase. A year ago, I think it was 65% of Americans felt hesitant about the quality that they would receive. Like, am I going to get the right kind of care that I'm paying for when I'm just talking to somebody on a video, right? And 56% of those did not believe it was possible to receive the same quality of care. That has changed now. Now, when they do these surveys, 80% of people feel it is possible to receive the same quality of care virtually. That's a huge change.
Dr. Law, what have you seen personally in your practice regarding virtual health visits?
I've had a couple of success stories stand out. One is that locally, our county medicine for jail medicine has had some issues with having providers come in there, especially during the pandemic. Years ago, I tried to get them to go into the realm of virtual health, and that was not accepted very well. But during this pandemic, that's been impossible to get physicians in there and also to have any of the precautions taken. So we were able to institute across the state of Kentucky, for instance, virtual health visits across all the community jails in all the different counties. And that has been a huge success. People that were in jail were able to get evaluated with Bluetooth technology that Laura mentioned earlier, Bluetooth stethoscopes, Bluetooth otoscopes, and ophthalmoscopes to look in the eyes and ears. And we were able to make judgments on whether or not something could be treated that way or whether or not we had to bring them in to be seen in person. So that was a huge success. And it really increased the access to care for that segment of the population. In my own population, with my Amish, Mennonite, and Plain communities, I have a large number of patients with different genetic diseases, such as cystic fibrosis. One family has 13 children, five of them have cystic fibrosis. And so you can imagine the amount of exposure and high risk that they are. And unfortunately, with their belief system, they're not using vaccinations there, nor are they using much in the way of medicines, but they do take pancreas and some other medicines that are needed for cystic fibrosis. When they get an upper respiratory infection, it can be deadly. And so with this pandemic, I was able to have a house in the area where they live, have the Bluetooth stethoscope and all the technology there. So they were able to use those devices. And I was able to auscultate, listen to their heart, lungs, and abdomen, look in their eyes, ears, nose, and throat. And I was about 75 miles away from where they were. And these are patients that have no electricity, no running water, getting the most advanced technology utilized for virtual health. And it was really able to keep them out of the hospital, keep their exposure down. They didn't have to run to the emergency room or to anywhere else every time one of the children had some runny nose or a bit of a fever. We were able to get stuff done in the homes. We even got to the point where we were able to keep some of these home testing units that they sell over the counter for COVID, as well as home testing kits for oxygenation of your blood, as well as urinalysis strips to keep there that they could dip themselves and then show me on the video, and I could look at the colors and distinguish it from here 75 miles away. It was spectacular in how it worked, and it really saved them a lot of heartache.
Awesome. So Matt, can you talk about what goes into developing a virtual care strategy for a practice and who is involved?
Yeah, so we know that the clinical care delivery is one of the most critical aspects of successfully conducting virtual health. You know, if you have a great process defined, you can feel confident that you've covered all the necessary components to deliver that high quality care and really properly qualify for those reimbursement codes. As a provider, you must also understand that what you should and should not be treating through virtual health. Understanding that some care must be done in person, but offering virtual health as an option where possible. Virtual options kind of give that patient autonomy in deciding the type of care delivery that they would like to receive. Of course, the other piece of this is having that technology in place to conduct these visits in the first place. In regards to who's involved, it's important to identify your team members from your practice who will be participating in these visits. This way, each team member knows their role and responsibility. It really should be mirroring in-person care. This helps the patient feel more comfortable and familiar throughout the process. For example, you may have your medical assistant or nurse. They can help virtually room that patient, answer any questions related to the visit, and prep the patient before seeing the provider. That same team member can also help conduct the visit and help with any follow-up instructions or referrals that they may have. Another example is your front desk. They can continue to help schedule visits for both in-person and virtual care, and really continue to spread that awareness around the availability of virtual health.
Is there a proper way to conduct a virtual visit? And can you talk a little bit about the etiquette?
Yeah, so first off, appearance, right? This should be no different than if you were in the office, just as if you were seeing that patient in person. In terms of workspace, create that professional workspace around you. Whether you're working from home or your office, really ensure that your space is clean and quiet. Of course, it's best to sit at a table or a desk where there's no distractions from noise and people walking by you. Communicate effectively. This is a little bit difficult doing that through virtual, but always introduce yourself. Don't assume that patient always knows who you are. Identify the patient and ask the patient to introduce anyone that may be in the room with them. We know that oftentimes a patient will bring a family member or friend that are involved in their care. So it's really important that you know who's in the room so that you can address them as well. Continue to maintain that eye contact with the patient. Look straight into the center of the camera or screen. Be aware of your body positioning, movement, facial gestures, and really that voice quality and vocal tone. Continue to be clear with any post-appointment instructions. Again, as if you were in person, make time to answer any final questions the patient may have and clarify instructions before disconnecting that session. Now, in terms of documentation, it really should be viewed as the same process for in-person care. All virtual health encounter documentation in the medical record is really expected to meet the same minimum standards as required by face-to-face visit documentation.
Great. And then can you talk to us a little bit about the technology?
Yeah, so we recommend a technology setup. Now we know that not all providers and healthcare professionals will have this sort of setup, but if at all possible, dual monitors is an optimal setup. You'll be able to have your patient on one up on one screen, and then maybe your EMR on the other screen. You can be documenting, maybe you can be sending prescriptions at the same time you're speaking to that patient. So a good setup to think about. And then in regards to the technology, we spoke a little bit about this earlier, having that camera on and centered, always check that the patient can see you. Check the lighting to see if you're in a well-lit area, adjust the camera filters as needed. And then for the audio, really making sure your mic and speaker are always on and within a reasonable distance from you. Speak in normal voices as you would in person. Most microphones nowadays are really meant to pick up sound well, so you and prevent you from having to raise your voice louder than you have to into that patient speaker.
Great, thank you. Dr. Law, how do you see physicians continuing to provide care to patients virtually when they have crossed state lines because of vacation or school or other reasons?
Yes, that has been an issue, and many physicians question the ability to continue to see their patients that way. We've had patients, for instance, that moved to another state because of maybe lax or regulations during the public health emergency. So we've had calls from doctors saying, how do I see my patient? They're living in Florida, so they can still go out to eat dinner, but I still want to take care of them kind of thing. And so, yeah, this has really been looked at and addressed, and it's addressed through the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact. It offers a voluntary and expedited pathway to licensure for physicians who wish to practice in multiple states. You know, the task, I can speak from experience, the task of obtaining a medical license in a state can take sometimes up to 6 months at least. And that's with probably 10 to 20 hours of personal work time trying to get all the pieces together, not to mention the number of entities you have to contact to help you get that process done. This can be extremely valuable if you can streamline this and allow providers to continue to care for their patients when they cross state lines. For example, you know, if they're traveling out of state or just temporarily moved, like I mentioned, or maybe they're away at school or they go to, you know, the warmer states during the winter months. This compact, this Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, is a legal agreement that came about somewhere in around 2013, which allowed states to work together to significantly streamline and expedite that process of licensing for physicians to practice in multiple states. The mission of the compact was to increase access to healthcare, particularly for patients underserved in rural areas. The compact made it possible to extend the reach of physicians, improve access to medical specialists even, and leverage virtual health technologies. The compact now includes 33 states, so that's pretty good, the District of Columbia and the Territory of Guam as member jurisdictions. The legislation is currently pending in four other states, Massachusetts, New Jersey, North Carolina, and New York. So we're hoping to add more on as time goes by. And we've noticed here at Highmark that even during this public health emergency, some smaller states that weren't part of the compact told us, yeah, we will lax our system to allow physicians to get through, still looking at the same guidelines, but expediting the process. Some states like the Kentucky only look at licenses twice a year. So no matter how soon you get your stuff in, if it's not their time of year to look for licenses, they don't do it. Well, during the public health emergency, state medical boards are really cooperative and saying, okay, get your stuff in and we'll look at it on an ad hoc basis. So even that has helped.
Great, thank you. Matt, how can healthcare professionals continue to spread awareness and adoption around virtual health?
Yeah, so, you know, it's important to create awareness around the availability for virtual visits within your practice. We know that virtual health has really taken off during the public health emergency, but it's important that we let our patients know that even after the public health emergency has ended, that virtual health is still a very viable and convenient option to continue receiving care. So there's different types of methods for accomplishing this. Of course, continuing to leverage your office staff to spread the word around virtual health. They are the front line and they probably talk to your patient more often than not. If your office uses email or physical mail, maybe you can work on sending out flyers that promote virtual health for your practice. If you have the ability to message patients via your EMR or even a patient portal, use that, right? So leveraging that technology to get information out to your patients can be a great way to inform them and keep them up to date with your offerings. So we like to offer some scripting that outlines the ability for your practice to conduct those visits. It's really important to include items such as, you know, what are the days and hours your virtual visits are offered? You know, how can a patient schedule that visit? Information if virtual visits are right for them. And then maybe even just including a list of common scenarios where virtual visits would be appropriate. You know, really having this in place will give the confidence to your patient that you're able to treat them via virtual technology. A couple examples that I like to offer, the first one being, you know, we're offering virtual visits for our patients. Our virtual visits allow you to see your doctor without ever having to leave your home, contact us today to schedule an appointment. Another one I really like is, hey, we're now offering virtual appointments. Not all illnesses are able to be treated by a virtual visit, but we help determine if a virtual or in-office appointment would be best for you. Just a couple of great examples.
Thank you, Matt. We are now nearing the end of our podcast. Dr. Law, if a provider had questions about how to conduct a virtual visit, coding or reimbursement questions, where could they go to find updated information?
Yes, well, as far as how to conduct a virtual visit, Laura and her team has put together a really great resource called the Virtual Health Handbook, and that can be found on the provider, a link to that can be found on the Provider Resource Center, as well as other links on there to look at different specialty societies, state medical boards, look at your local area. You know, a lot of this is available at your local and state organizations as well.
Great, thank you. So as we wrap up our conversation, I want to thank Laura Messino, Matt Farrer, and Dr. Timothy Law for joining us today. Your insights really helped us understand the what, why, and how of virtual health. And thank you to our clinicians for tuning into this podcast. We encourage you to share it with your colleagues who may be interested in integrating virtual health into their practice. And additional tools and resources on virtual health can be found on the Highmark Provider Resource Center. Thank you very much.